PA Books is a production of PCN, a nonprofit television network. Listeners like you make our programming possible. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
Welcome to the PA Books Podcast. I'm Phil Beckman. PA Books features interviews with authors about Pennsylvania history, culture, and people. In this episode, we talk to Terrence Belt, the author of Unclaimed Valor, the history of the 130th Regiment, Pennsylvania Volunteer Infantry.
This week on PA Books, Terrence Belt, author of Unclaimed Valor.
Terrence Belt is the author of Unclaimed Valor, the history of the 130th Regiment, Pennsylvania Volunteer Infantry. Terry, what was the state of the war in 1862 when these volunteer infantry regiments were being raised?
Well, it was just in the beginning stages, and Lincoln called for 300,000 new troops to be recruited by different states, and Pennsylvania was one of them that met the obligation pretty quickly. And my great-grandfather served in Company C, the 130th. And I can kind of picture him sitting at the breakfast table reading the Hanover newspaper at the time and reading about the request for volunteers. And he said, I think I'm going to volunteer, because back in those days, to be drafted, and they were calling for a draft possibly, it was a dishonor to be drafted. You know, it was a shame. You know, they have to come and get me. No, I want to volunteer and serve my country. So that was kind of the state. The Pennsylvanians were eager and ready to serve, and they did.
Now, these volunteer regiments would be called up for 9 months service. Was that the normal enlistment length during that time period?
At that time, I believe there were like 12 or 13 that were recruited. Initially, I believe some of them were 3 months. Then they got into 9 months, and then maybe a little further later on. But later on, it was the three-year enlistment, because Lincoln thought the war was going to continue longer than the 9 months.
So did your great-grandfather, did he leave behind any letters or photographs?
Unfortunately, no. I sure wish that he did. He did not. I know a lot about him. But I've searched and searched for images and photographs, and I thought I came across one at the York County Historical Society, which is the York History Center now. And it turns out it was his cousin. Same name, same occupation, about the same age. And it was a GAR picture. But my great-grandfather had passed away. But what's interesting is my great-grandfather is buried in Prospect Hill Cemetery. And so is his cousin up the hill. And in 1930, when the government issued the government markers for the federal troops, they put the wrong marker on my great-grandfather's grave. They put his cousin's on it. So after a lot of research and trips at the archives, I found the other cousin's information, and it was the wrong marker. So I corrected it, had a new one made. And the cemetery was nice enough not to charge me, and they moved the old one to the rightful owner up on the hill, which was his cousin's grave. So it's never too late to correct history.
What was the role of the Pennsylvania state government in raising these regiments?
The role was basically the governor had a requirement to raise X amount of troops, and he did. So they met their quota pretty quickly. Each state was given a quota.
For the 130th Regiment, what part of Pennsylvania was the region that it was recruiting from?
Most of them came from the York and Hanover County. Also some from Cumberland County as well. A few others from out east, I think. I forget the name of the county, but it's Montgomery County, I believe, closer to Philadelphia. But most of them were within probably about maybe a 60, 70-mile radius. And when they showed up at Camp Curtin, you know, they showed up at certain times. I'm not sure if the people at Camp Curtin tried to group them based on geographics or not, but that's how it ended up, and which was good because some of them knew each other, I think.
How important were community relationships to the recruitment process? If your neighbor is volunteering, does that impact the other people's desire to volunteer?
In my opinion, yes, because like if my great-grandfather volunteered, if his neighbor heard about that, he would want to volunteer as well. And you see a lot of the brothers that volunteered at the same time. And there's you can also see them when they go into battle, like in Antietam, a couple of times the brothers were side by side and they were both either wounded or killed at the same time. So yeah, there was an influence, definitely.
So once all these people volunteered, you mentioned Camp Curtin in Harrisburg. Was Harrisburg the central rallying point for them?
It was. Camp Curtin was the training grounds. And that's where they all showed up and they received some brief training, not much. There's a plaque there. It's in Harrisburg, but it's kind of, I think, to the west of town a little bit. I believe there's a plaque and maybe a small park, but I remember the plaque. I've been there several times.
How were the officers selected?
They were pretty much selected by the men themselves. However, when you got into the higher ranks, like the regimental commander, the people at Camp Curtin, particularly one person individual, liked Colonel Zinn. He had some charisma about him. He was a school teacher, very well respected by his men, and they saw some leadership qualities about him. So they named him the acting colonel of the regiment. Of course, he didn't get the rank until a little later on in his career, but he was finally granted the rank. But he was selected by the Camp Curtin staff. But generally, the lower ranking officers were selected by the men. But sometimes the lower ranking officers, actually captains and lieutenants, recruited the men. And you can see there's a poster where there was a call to arms that you have an image of that, that shows they were trying to recruit men from York.
Colonel Henry Zinn, the regimental commander, you mentioned he was a school teacher. Did he have military experience before this?
Nothing. He was a school teacher. No, none at all. But he was, he had some qualities that they recognized as a leader, which he ended up turning it out that he certainly was.
Were the soldiers offered bonuses of any type to sign up?
Some of them were, yes. And if you look at that poster that I sent you, it does show some bonuses that are offered. Not all, but some did. Some just volunteered. Then you get I've ran into some cases where men from other regiments would leave unexpectedly, and they would rejoin under a different name to collect another bonus, another bounty. That happened some, not too often, but it did happen. I think they called them bounty jumpers.
Once the troops were organized in Harrisburg, where did they go?
They arrived at an area called Fort Marcy, which is in the outer defenses of Washington, D.C. Well, they called it Washington City at the time. It's on the other side of the river. And they were one of the regiments that basically built this camp. The camp still exists today as it's just a small park and anybody can go visit it. But they were one of the first ones there.
And one of the experiences that you write about in the book was that George McClellan came through the area and they were to see him for the first time. Why was that significant for them?
Because he was very well liked by all the men. He had some certain charisma about him. He was their leader. And it was just an important aspect of what was going on at the time and how they felt about him. And he was very, very well loved at the time.
At the time that they were in Northern Virginia, at Fort Marcy, the Second Battle of Bull Run was underway or going on. And what was their experience like? They were not in the battle, but how did they experience it?
You know, I read in my research that they heard some of the noise, some of the cannons from where they were located. And they were put on the defensive on a line, thinking that second play would they would end up entering the outer defenses of DC. Of course, it didn't happen, but they were put on a line just in case.
Now, that after the Second Battle of Bull Run, Robert E. Lee leads the Army of Northern Virginia across the Potomac River into Maryland. How did the Army of the Potomac respond?
They responded by sending forces through up through Maryland, up through Frederick, Maryland, and then they ended up going into Antietam. They had some idea that something was going to happen. Now, the regiment actually went through South Mountain first, and they arrived at the end of the battle. And you can read in the book, it was dark at the time, and some of the men, they just retired, so they lay down and went to sleep. When they woke up, they were lying, sleeping among a bunch of dead Union soldiers, which they didn't. They thought they were sleeping at the time. Yeah, so, they were first sight of death, I believe.
Well, let's follow their journey from Fort Marcy up towards Antietam. So first, you mentioned that they go to Rockville, Maryland.
Yeah, they were there as well. Mm-hmm. Then they went up to Frederick. Then they went up to Antietam through there. They turned left, and they went south to Antietam Creek and Antietam-Sharpsburg.
So once they leave Frederick, they cross over the Catoctin Mountains into a small valley before getting to South Mountain. Now, there was a small battle fought in one of the gaps there. What was their experience of that like?
They were not involved in that. That was pretty much south of them. So they did not participate in that.
So as they're approaching Sharpsburg and the battle's going on, correct? So they're able to hear the sounds of the battle?
At that time, as far as I know, it really hadn't started. I think maybe there was some cannon fire in the distance that they heard, that I believe is in the book, but nothing significant. I mean, the cornfield wasn't until when they just arrived there. So they were not in the cornfield. They were in the area in Bloody Lane, which was later on in that day.
So take us through their approach to where the battle was taking place and how they worked their way into a combat.
They were led across the creek, and it was kind of a lot of funny stories about them crossing the creek because some of them didn't want to take their boots off, the shoes at the time, and they just waded across, and before they went into battle, they were all soaking wet across the creek, at least from the waist down. The creek was probably waist high. So they crossed the creek, and they followed a certain path that took them up to what's called the Roulette Farm. And I've been there several times, and they halted there for a while. And then from that point, they went up the hill. I've been on the Roulette Farm property many times, and there's a hill. And what's a lot of stories about going up the hill, one is the story about the bees, which is in the book. There was one regiment before them that evidently knocked over some bee houses, the beehives. And as the 130th went through, the bees just surrounded them. And they said, you know, the enemy was easier on us than the bees were. So that was kind of a funny story going up. But they ended up going up to the hill, and they made a line. And that's where they defended the hill. And the Confederates were on the other side of Bloody Lane, which is it was a farmer's lane, and it was sunk down over the years because of wagons going back and forth. And it was, they were probably maybe 100 to 150 feet away from the Confederates on the other side.
So as the 130th is going into combat for the first time, what was their experience like?
Their experience was, I guess, shock and awe, you might want to say. You know, never been in combat before. They had no idea what was going on, but they did their duty. They did their duty, and they a lot of stories from men that you can read about in the book, and I have a lot more about what they experienced. And they saw their comrades go down, some of them wounded, some of them killed. But they stood their line. They didn't falter, didn't retreat. And they stood there for, I think, several hours holding the line.
And what was the outcome of their part of the fight? Did they manage to defeat the Confederates in that part of the battle?
It wasn't totally over by then. I believe that they left before it, but they were pretty much still there towards the end. But they didn't see the very end, as far as I know. Did not see the total end. They went back and regrouped, and the wounded were collected and sent to nearby hospitals. They're basically the hospitals were houses. And that's where the surgeons did their work.
Well, once the battle was over, they repositioned to Harper's Ferry. How significant was Harper's Ferry as a military center at that time, and what was their experience there like?
Let me go back one just a little bit in the back. When they stayed in the Antietam area for several days, and one of their tasks was to bury the dead, and there's an image of them burying the dead that I found in, I think, Harper's Weekly or Leslie's, but it shows them burying the dead. But I've tried to find out why, and somewhere along the line it said it was at the displeasure of a commander. I don't know which commander, the corps or a division commander, but they did that for several days. So once they were relieved of that, they did go to Harper's Ferry. And Harper's Ferry was just a respite. It was for them. It was them to rest, regroup, get their equipment in shape. And I believe a lot of their baggage hadn't arrived yet, but I believe it came when they got to Harper's Ferry later on. You know, the personal belongings, the little that they had, showed up. And later on, while they were at Harper's Ferry, that's where they received the regimental flag from Pennsylvania. Before that, they just had flank markers. I don't think they had any flag, like a Pennsylvania flag. And I do not know if they had a United States flag or not at the time. I could not find that out.
We'll be back in a moment with the PA Books Podcast.
Enjoying this podcast? Please support PCN with a donation at PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.
The next battle they would participate in would be Fredericksburg, Virginia. How did they make their way from Harper's Ferry down to the Rappahannock River?
They went through Warrenton. And an interesting fact that showed up that I read about is one morning while they were in Warrenton, they were all called up early in the morning. And they said, we need to line up on the road, on the main road going to Warrenton. I think it was called the Warrenton Turnpike at the time. And they didn't know why, but they all lined up. And not too long after that, a group of men came by, and it was McClellan and Burnside, and they saw it. It was when McClellan was relieved and Burnside took command of the army. And it's kind of interesting that the regiment was there and they saw all this. But from then there, they bivouacked a few times, and they ended up making it to Fredericksburg, and they actually went to, they spent time at Belleplain Landing first, helping unloading ships, that kind of thing. But they didn't have much in terms of tentage. They had the shelter tents. But one story I read, I'm not sure if it's in the book or not, I think I put it in there, was that the big tents, the large tents that everybody wanted, a couple of them went up to one of the ships and one of the men that was unloading, and they kind of told them a lot that they were here to pick up their large campy tent. So they gave it to him. So they got a large tent out of it. Mysteriously, it appeared kind of funny. But they stayed there for a while, I think a couple weeks possibly. And then from there, they went down to Falmouth.
What was Burnside's plan for Fredericksburg?
I'm no expert here, but he basically wanted a full frontal attack. He wanted to go straight across the river. He ordered the pontoon bridges, which, by the way, the 130th did help help a little bit with the construction, I think, the middle bridge at the time. But his idea was to capture the city and then make a frontal attack up to the hill to Murray's Heights. Now, other commanders were against it. One of the commanders was a General Couch. He was totally against it. And most others were. They wanted to come in from the flanks, not from the front. But Burnside was adamant. And it ended up being his doom of command, you might say, because he was relieved later.
Now, with the 130th would cross over the pontoons into the city. What was the city like when they arrived?
By that time, it was already bombarded. It was destroyed. And there's stories about men stealing things, you know, walking around with women's hats on and things like that. It was just a mess at the time. I think, to my knowledge, they weren't involved in much of that. I think everybody was after the whiskey at the time. Not sure if they were or not, but then that was one big thing. But it was already just pretty much destroyed at the time, and the civilian population had pretty much left by that time.
Where were the Confederate troops positioned?
They were up on the hill, which was near Altamira with Murray's Heights, which was, if you were downtown, you had to go south, crossed over a field and the fairgrounds. It was open land at the time, and it was like a little creek running through it, a depression that was kind of hard to navigate through, but they did. That was about halfway between the two. So they had to navigate through that field. But going up was tough. I think they were like the second group in, close to the first group of the second group. And going up in the book, one of the company commanders, I think from Company E, his name was Captain Laughlin from Company E from Newville, marching up a cannonball, took his head off right in front of the men. That was devastating for sure. But they all marched through it and they ended up online. From the Stonewall, I've been close to the area where they were, and it was a little further back. You know, they went right on the wall, but they were close. I'm thinking 100 to 150 feet, something like that. It's all housing now. But the National Park Service is trying to, when the houses go up for sale, they're buying the houses, raising them, and trying to return that area to the appearance it was during the war, which is good. That's nice.
How intense was the fire that the men of the 130th faced from the Confederates?
To my knowledge, it was pretty intense because they were fairly close enough to get it. And I mean, the Confederates were right on the line, right by the wall, and they were literally trying to mow down the Union troops as much as they could. And this will we get to the interesting part about Colonel Zinn.
Well, tell us what happened to Colonel Zinn.
Colonel Zinn, again, a very well beloved commander. He was in the line, and I believe, I don't have facts about this, but the colors, from what I understand, the flag, the Pennsylvania flag, was in the area of Company C. That's where my uncle served. And him and the color barrel and probably some other men right around him, the color barrel went down with the flag, and Colonel Zinn said something like the 130th flag never goes down. He grabs the flag, and instantly he is shot, I think, in the head near the eye, and he dies almost instantly, holding the flag, and then he goes down with the flag. Somebody else later picks it up. But the end of a very young life and a beloved commander, and it was really sad. I think Captain Jenkins took temporary command from Company C until they went back, and later on somebody else took command. But that was a sad event. He his body was recovered, and I believe it was the Reverend that took the body back home to his wife. But in March of 1862, they had a son. His name, James, he was born in 1859. He died in March of 1862 as a toddler. So 1862 was set off tragically. Then her husband, Henry, was killed on 13 December. And then what's even worse is their daughter, Elsie, she's born in 1855. She died, I think, of typhoid or a disease of some type in December of 1862, not long after her husband was killed. So she lost a son, a husband, and a daughter within a very short time period. They had one son that was remaining, George. He was born in 1861 in January. And a little story about him, he took care of his mother all throughout her life. And the individual that took command of the regiment after Colonel Zinn was killed later was Levi Maish, like Maish, M-A-I-S-H, who later became a U.S. congressman for Pennsylvania, interesting. And he would give George Zinn an appointment to West Point later on. George stayed in the military and retired as a colonel. He followed his father's footsteps in a way, which was kind of interesting. The men looked after themselves after the war to a point. I learned that they helped each other out, and this is what Colonel Maish, then Congressman Maish, did for the Zinn family.
After the Battle of Fredericksburg, where did the 130th go?
They went back up to Falmouth for a while. They were a little story about they weren't involved in Burnside's famous mud march that people read about, that he sent several divisions of Union soldiers up trying to go towards Chancellorsville, which they'd failed because it was rainy, muddy. It was worst time of year to do that. And the men of the 130th, they had a big laugh about it, but they helped the troops when they came back to dislodge a lot of the cannons and the other equipment from the mud when they came back. So the 130th was involved, but they were involved in, I guess, helping them get back, helping the Union troops get back to their camps in Falmouth.
The next battle they would participate in was Chancellorsville. What was their role in that battle?
Their role was, actually, they didn't know when they arrived there. When they arrived, the adjutant, whose name was John Hayes, which I'll talk about, went up to the Corps commander at the time, which was General Couch, and he asked him where to go, and Couch gave him some nasty words in return. And he basically said, go over where you think you need it. So they didn't have a place for them, but they figured out where they wanted to go. So they did. It was getting close to the evening at the time. And I can go into John Hayes right now, which might be an interesting point, but I won't give away the whole story. But once the 130th found a place where they should be, they were pretty close to the Chancellor's house. If you've ever been to Chancellorsville, the Chancellor's house was destroyed, but it was at the intersection of the Plank Road, several roads there, famous house, but it was just totally destroyed, but they were near there. And then later on, John Hayes went out, he was the adjutant, to kind of survey the area to see what else maybe they could go or kind of plot the area. But at that time, he may have changed the course of the war unknowingly. And it had to do with Stonewall Jackson. I can tell the story if you like.
Yes, please.
The story is, he was on horseback and he went towards the enemy line, but he wasn't exactly sure. It was getting dark, if not dark at the time. And he came across a group of idle horsemen, is what he says in his letters. He dismounted and tied his horse loosely to a tree and kind of walked up a little further. And within seconds, he heard rounds of gunfire going off. So he wondered what happened. Then he took off. He got his horse and went back to where his regiment was at the time. But it wasn't until a couple of days later where he read in one of the newspapers, Union newspapers, that Stonewall Jackson was wounded. And later he would die of pneumonia. But what appears to have happened, and this is under, I believe it's true, but the National Park Service believes it's very probable. But the idea was, the noise that his horse made drew the attention of the Confederates that had just taken the line. They took the place of some other Confederates on the line, where they heard Hayes, but they saw Jackson and his men. Now Hayes's location, he was a little below. So when they were firing, they saw Jackson and his men, and that's when they hit Jackson. And again, Hayes missed the fire because he was below them. He was down the road. I'm not sure how far the road is. If you look, it's still there. So he learned that, hey, I might have been involved in that. Years later, he returned to Fredericksburg, and he met Kai Douglas, who was on the staff of Jackson, who was there at the time. And they became friends. Met him at the train station, and he said, we're going to take the horse and buggy and going to ride out to the battlefield spot. And I'm going to find the spot where I was, but don't tell me where he was. I want to find it myself. And they did. When they arrived, Hayes took him right to the spot where he was, and Douglas took him down where Jackson and his entourage was, and it was the same place. So at that point, it appears that Hayes may have changed the course of the war, dealing with the wounded and ultimately sad passing of General Jackson. All this is in letters from John Hayes, he has written, and it's at Dickerson College up in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. So Hayes went on to he was an attorney. He was an attorney when he went in. Went in to being a great, member of the Society of Carlisle, Pennsylvania. He founded Frog and Switch, and they manufactured railroad equipment and things like that. I met his great-great-grandson, did an interview with him. He's passed away, which was really interesting, and he told me a lot of the stories, too. He was then the president of the company at the time. Great stories.
At the time of the Chancellorsville battle, the 130th, they were now combat veterans. They fought at Antietam and Fredericksburg. How did that change their experience of this battle?
They were pretty much, I thought, holding the line at the time. They weren't involved in any offensive operations, but they did hold the line. And when the 11th Corps came back, the 11th Corps ran through them, but the 1/3 stayed their place in line. Did not retreat. So they did hold the line and protect the retreating Union people, soldiers that went back. And eventually, the Union would retreat back over the river and go back to their winter quarters in Palm.
Now, the 130th had been recruited for 9 months. At some point, their 9 months is up, and they return home. What was homecoming like for them?
In my readings, especially in other regiments, a lot of them reenlisted. And they went on, some of them went on to great things. I believe one of them received the Medal of Honor somewhere else. But a lot of them joined the 87th Pennsylvania and a few other local regiments. But I would say, I wish I have a number, but I would say at least, well, maybe 50% rejoined other regiments at the time, because they felt that their duty was not done. I mean, their 9 month was over, but they were still needed.
Well, we've been speaking with Terrence Belts. He is the author of Unclaimed Valor, the history of the 130th Regiment Pennsylvania Volunteer Infantry. Terry, thanks for joining me.
Well, thank you for having me.
Listeners like you make PCN programming possible. Full episodes of PA Books, as well as other PCN programs, are available to stream with the PCN Select app. To learn more about PCN's mission and to support PCN with a donation, visit PCNTV.com. This link and others can be found in our show notes. We appreciate your support.